I will call the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee to order. Today is February 20th, 2025. The first bill, we'll approve the minutes shortly here, but the first bill is a Representative Franzen bill, and I've gotten good word that she has left her own committee and is in transit from G23. But the first order of the business is the approval of the minutes, and our sharp eye over here, Representative Mueller, has found a spelling error, and please don't tell John Choi that his name was spelled wrong, his last name. But we will correct that. It's the very last line of the minutes, members. Should be C-H-O-I, and so we will correct that accordingly. Other than that, Representative Ingen.
I'm so sorry, Madam Chair. I've noticed that my name's been spelt wrong every time. I don't like saying anything because it's the better way of spelling Elliot, the easier way, but there are two T's on that. So
okay, what correction needs to be made?
Just a second T.
A second T
on
Elliot. Okay.
Only
double L, double T. So noted.
Thanks.
So the CLA will make those corrections in the future, and everything's going to be great. So with those two amendments to the minutes, anything else? Members, all those in favor of approving the amendments as amended, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Minutes are adopted. Representative Franzen, just in time. Did you bring treats?
I did, so I brought cookies because I have other bills off today, so just grab one.
Wow, it was worth the wait. Thank you for being here today, and we are ready for your bill. Just so members know, we are going to be laying this bill over, and I hope that we can all be respectful of Representative Franzen's time this morning on her bill. She is a committee chair and needs to get back to her own committee eventually here. So with that, Representative Franzen, I will move House File 414. And do I move it even though we're laying it over? Yeah, I do. Yeah. Okay. So House File 414 is before us. Representative Franzen, go ahead and speak to your bill, please.
Thank you. Members, and the cookies come from Alexandria, the city that is easy to get to and hard to leave, from a place called Sugar Shack. They're purple because in our very bipartisan manner these next 2 years. So anyway, good morning, members of the committee. I'm here today to present House File 414, a bill that seeks to ensure fairness, promote transparency, and strengthen accountability in our government by reducing the filing fee for complaints related to the Minnesota Data Practices Act. This change is crucial to making the system more accessible to everyone, regardless of their economic status. One of the main goals of this bill is to make it easier for individuals, particularly those from lower income backgrounds, to hold the government accountable. We want to ensure the ability to hold government accountable, especially when Minnesotans believe the law has been violated. It is not limited to a select few. Currently, the filing fee for complaints is $1,000. This simply is too high of a barrier for many Minnesotans to afford, and as a result, it creates an unnecessary barrier to seeking justice. By reducing the fee from $1,000 to $200, we are ensuring the right to file a complaint is available to everyone, not just those who are financially privileged. By lowering the filing fee, we are not just making the system more equitable, we are also taking a key step toward promoting transparency and accountability within our government. This bill will expand opportunity for Minnesotans to engage with government oversight. More people will now be able to file complaints and bring attention to potential violations of the law, which is extremely important. Additionally, this change will help align the filing fee with other rates already set by the Office of Administrative Hearings. Currently, in all other states, the maximum fee is $600. By reducing this fee, we are ensuring consistency across the board. Trust is the foundation of any democratic society, and this bill helps to build trust between citizens and their government. By reducing the filing fee, We are offering a structured mechanism for people to address grievances regarding government actions or inactions regarding data practice requests, no matter their income level. This change empowers citizens to take action if they believe government entities are violating data access. It creates an exclusive and robust system of oversight, strengthening the very fabric of our democratic processes. Members, in conclusion, this bill ensures fairness, promotes transparency, increases accountability. It is a common sense step toward ensuring that all Minnesotans, regardless of income, have an opportunity to engage with their government and hold it accountable. I urge you to support this important legislation. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Representative Franzen. Just to point members to the packets, there is a filing fee and rate chart here, and you will see that the $1,000 filing fee is quite an outlier in relation to other filing fees. So even annexing to a municipality is cheaper than a filing fee to get sought-after data from the government and receive justice through the Department the OAH. So any member questions or discussion on the bill? Yes, Representative Finke.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Franzen for your bill. I think I support this bill. I don't know for sure, and I'm not. I certainly support what the bill is trying to do. I come from journalism. I come from the world of wanting to make sure we are holding government accountable and not shielding any data from the public. I know we're laying this bill over, so I won't get to move it forward with you. But I would love to know before we get to whatever the next stage of this is, what the average cost of one of these inquiries, right, one of these data requests is, just so we can place the 1,000 compared to, oh, when you get this, this is how much it costs an agency to comply with that request. I don't have any idea what that is. $1,000 to make the request does seem to me to be wildly exorbitant, but I'm just looking for a little context for that in terms of what it does with the agency who gets that request.
Representative Finke, it's a good point. By the time it gets to the OAH, and it's usually the member of the public has exhausted, you know, they've asked the agency for information. They're either getting stonewalled or they're getting an answer that they're not pleased with. And so by that time, if there was any data at all provided, well, there wouldn't have been. So it depends on the scope of the ask, I would say. But I think one of the things we're going to try to do, too, is try to get a fiscal note from the OAH to see how many cases more, you know, it's going to be pretty hard to figure out, you know, how many more people are going to be able to afford to have access to this. But certainly they're going to do their best to get us a fiscal note on it. And we know that that is one of the reasons I'm laying it over today, is we just don't know.
And so, a fiscal note has been requested, Madam Chair.
So a fiscal note has been requested. And Representative Finke, I'm so glad to hear that you want transparency in government. So I'm assuming you're going to be voting for the NISCA bill on the floor this afternoon. So anyway, any other questions? Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you, Chair Franzen, for the bill. I agree. This $1,000 it literally pops out on the page. I'm just curious if you know, where did the $1,000 come from? It sounds like there had to be an effort to make it this expensive, and I'm just curious if you know what that is.
I do not know what that is, but I've had concerned citizens that were very concerned that the $1,000 themselves was a barrier, and brought the information forward, and I too looked at it and said, "Holy Hannah, this is quite an outlier." So we're just addressing some concerns that citizens would like to have addressed.
Thank you. And if I might,
Representative Curran.
Thank you for that. And, again, I agree. this is an astronomical financial barrier to the average person. $1,000 is a lot of money. I'm in agreement. Money's a barrier, and I don't think we should put really expensive barriers in front of people when they're just trying to access information. So,
thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Vinken.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Franson, for bringing this bill forward. I actually looked it up here. Bankrate had a report just a month ago that showed 59% of Americans couldn't afford a $1,000 emergency health expense. So a $1,000 filing fee for a data request is obviously a barrier, and I appreciate you bringing this bill forward. Thank you.
Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to be clear that this is for complaints. Like the data request is a separate thing. Okay, I'm seeing some head nodding. And then this is actually what's for complaints. And I'm just curious because I wonder what the cost if someone was to go to the district court instead of the administrative law process that this provides, what would the filing fee be in district court? And maybe Nonpartisan can help us with that. Thanks.
Where's Nathan? Oh, there's Nathan. I lost you there. Mr. Hopkins.
Madam Chair, so if you were to file a complaint in district court under the civil action that's authorized under Chapter 13, I can look up the filing fee in Minnesota district courts, but it would be the same as any other civil complaint in district court. It looks like civil action or proceeding in district court is typically $285 for the initial complaint.
Okay, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Franson, I think we all kind of agree on the underlying concern here. And you know, I appreciate that. You know, we all are thinking about people who have really struggled, as Representative Engen mentioned, you know, to cover just basic things. A lot of people live pretty paycheck to paycheck. That's a reality. So I appreciate the underlying concern that brings this bill here. I do have some concerns about it, though. And one of them is that I think as I look at the law, calling this a fee is a bit of a misnomer. That's what the law calls it, but it really isn't a fee as I'm understanding it. And maybe Nonpartisan, if I'm getting this wrong or if you think I'm getting this wrong, please correct me. But this is more of a deposit. I look at it more as an escrow to cover costs of the administrative hearing process if the person bringing the action loses. It's not really a fee. It's not like you pay your fee and it's gone. That doesn't take away the concern because somebody has to still come up with that $1,000. I get that. But it really isn't a fee. So when we look and we say, well, you know, this fee is out of line, it's not really a fee, even though clearly they're calling it that. But also in the statute, which is, you know, in the bill, it lays out more of the statute. So you see that it says a filing fee of $1,000 or a bond to guarantee the payment of this fee. So again, it's kind of written oddly. It's not really, I assume, to guarantee the payment of the fee, but to cover the costs of the proceeding. So do you know, if you would, anything about that bond? Like, what does it cost somebody if they go the bond route? Do they, obviously, if you get a bond, you have to pay something for that, and that's money you don't get back. But do you have any information about that? Because the person under the law here, they don't really have to come up with $1,000. They could get the bond. So that's one question that I have, if
okay,
we could.
Well, it's
Chair Franson.
Yep, sorry, Madam Chair. Representative Liebling, well, it's true that prevailing complaints receive a refund. I don't have the answer to your bond question. However, the underlying issue remains that Minnesotans shouldn't have to take on a financial risk in the first place if they want to bring forward a complaint. I don't have the specifics on the bond. Maybe Nonpartisan staff can help with that.
Shall we ask John Patterson?
Yeah, please.
Mr. Hopkins, if you happen to have an answer regarding the bond.
Madam Chair and members, so I don't know exactly what the fee would be. It would vary. You'd have to go to the private market to get a bond for $1,000. There would be, as Representative Liebling mentioned, a fee that the person would have to pay in order to get the $1,000 bond. It would vary depending upon the vendor, however.
Thank you.
Okay. Madam Chair, thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. So, you know, I think it's really important before we go and make this change, which is a big change, that we understand really what a person really does have to do. And the idea that someone should have no barrier or, I mean, clearly even under your bill, there is a barrier. So I think we probably all agree that some barrier is appropriate. Otherwise, you know, why would a person, if they could ask for any kind of data and even knowing they weren't going to get it and then appeal and you know, we don't want to waste everybody's time on frivolous stuff. So somehow we try to set some sort of a bar so that at least it's a serious appeal. So I think it would be important to know that. I also wanted to ask you, Representative Franson, if you have talked to the Office of Administrative Hearings or the League of Minnesota Cities or the Association of Minnesota Counties or, you know, some of the entities that might be affected, because it seems like the impact of this would be to increase the number of appeals. And obviously that's why we need a fiscal note. But I just wonder if you've consulted with any of those entities as you came forward with the bill.
Chair Franson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Liebling, I have not, nor have they come to oppose me in my office regarding the legislation. But members, reducing the filing fee to $200 aims to just make the process more accessible while still ensuring that complaints are serious and not frivolous. So that's, we're just trying to maintain some sort of a barrier, but not one that people are just like constantly, here's, you know, another complaint, but that just brings that financial barrier in line with other barriers that we have already in statute.
Okay, and then, Madam Chair, thank you. And then, Representative Franson, if somebody pays the lower, if the bill passes and the fee is reduced or the escrow money is reduced, and what happens if the person does do the appeal and it runs up a lot of costs and they lose? Does the person still have to then, are they expected to pay the cost even though we weren't holding on to their fee to account for it? Maybe you don't know the answer. Maybe nonpartisan staff will know the answer, but I'm just wondering how this works. Like, you know, the purpose of this, as I'm reading here in the law, is to guarantee the payment of a fee if a person loses. What if we lower this and they lose? Do they still have to pay more than to pay these costs, or are we just covering it for them if it turns out to be a frivolous appeal?
Yeah. Let's ask nonpartisan staff if that's okay, because I suppose it's foreseeable that somebody could even go over $1,000 in their appeal now. So Mr. Hopkins.
So Madam Chair and members, so the petitioner is going to pay that $1,000 filing fee. If the petitioner substantially prevails, the complainant substantially prevails, they're entitled to a full refund of the fee, less $50. And then if they do not substantially prevail on their complaint, they're entitled to a refund of the filing fee less the costs incurred by the Office of Administrative Hearings in conducting the matter. So that could certainly go all the way up to the $1,000. So if they don't substantially prevail on the merits, they could see no refund of the $1,000 filing fee.
Right. Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mr. Hopkins, I guess, though, the question, and maybe it's one for the Office of Administrative Hearings, what if the cost is actually more than the $1,000, or if the bill was to succeed more than the $200, does that just mean that the office eats the rest and the person doesn't have to pay it? I mean, that's kind of the question.
Mr. Hopkins.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, yes, there would be the petitioner, if they do not substantially prevail on the merits of the complaint, would not be obligated to pay more than that $1,000. if the Office of Administrative Hearings finds that the complaint is frivolous or brought for the purposes of harassment, the complainant may be ordered by the administrative law judge to pay the respondent's attorney's fees not to exceed $5,000.
Chair Liebling and I, okay. Mr. Walls was, ask Mary. Mr. Walls is coming to the table. We only have so many spots here, so they have to play musical chairs. Go ahead, Mr. Walls.
Madam Chair and members, there is a preliminary fiscal note in the system, but it is not yet complete. I reviewed it this morning. I'm sorry I did not bring my computer, so I don't have access to it. The estimated loss so far that they're arriving at is $5,000 in revenue on an annual basis. The Office of Administrative Hearings operates off both a general fund of appropriation of somewhere in the neighborhood of $40,000. The fees that we're talking about here go into a fund, and they generate about $30,000 a year. However, the Office of Administrative Hearings currently operates at a deficit. They do have the authority to transfer money in from an account that I believe is related to campaign finance fees. And so they have been doing that on an annual basis to make up the shortfall in their operation.
Thank you. Representative Liebling, or?
Okay, well, thank you. That's helpful. So, I mean, I just would close by saying I appreciate the sentiment behind this, and we all share that. But obviously, it's a little bit more complicated than it appears, and it would be great to change. If we have this thing and it is refundable and all that, it would be great if the statute would actually say what it really is, which is not a fee. But appreciate you bringing the bill, Representative Franson. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Seeing no other member questions, the bill is laid over. Thank you, Chair Franzen, for presenting this good bill.
Thank you, members.
Members, the next bill is House File 768. Vice Chair Hudson has this bill, and welcome to the testifiers' table. Representative Hudson, would you like to move your bill?
That is my motion, Madam Chair.
Very good. House File 768 is before us. I understand there is a technical amendment to your bill. Representative Hudson.
That is correct, Madam Chair. Thank you. The A4 amendment is an author's amendment that is intended to put the bill in the form that I intended. It deletes the new language proposed in page 3, line 2.
Very good. Any discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all members in favor of adopting the amendment, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. To your bill, Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Today, I'm here to present a critical piece of legislation that reinforces our constitutional rights, prevents government overreach, and maintains fair and effective anti-discrimination efforts. HF 768 is designed to uphold protected speech by safeguarding individuals' rights to freely express their own opinions without fear of government monitoring. The First Amendment is a cornerstone of our constitutional republic and essential to our democratic process. This bill reaffirms that protected speech cannot be monitored or tracked by the government. Free speech is a fundamental right, even if it may find certain views or some people may find certain views controversial or offensive. This bill ensures that individuals can express dissent, discuss sensitive topics, and engage in healthy debate without fear of being added to a database. Allowing a government entity to maintain a database on protected, perceived offensive speech creates a chilling effect and discourages open debate and discussion. Further, the United States Supreme Court has repeatedly upheld that the government cannot regulate or track speech simply because it is unpopular. Other states have faced legal challenges when agencies overstepped constitutional boundaries by monitoring speech. This bill ensures that the government does not infringe upon free expression while continuing to enforce anti-discrimination laws. What this bill does not do is prevent the Department of Human Rights from investigating legitimate discrimination. It simply ensures that speech itself, no matter how controversial, is not tracked in a government database. If speech crosses into harassment, threats, or illegal discrimination, existing law already provides a way to address it. This bill does not change or weaken those protections. Protecting free speech and combating discrimination are not mutually exclusive. Both can be upheld in a fair and lawful manner. That is my bill, Madam Chair, and I believe there is one testifier.
If you are here to testify, please come forward, state your name for the record, and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Rihanna Lee. I'm the Legislative and Coalitions Director for the Americans for Prosperity chapter here in Minnesota. AFP is dedicated to protecting and preserving the First Amendment and stopping threats to free speech. The First Amendment is the cornerstone of a free society, and it ensures that every American has the power to think, speak, and act as they see fit, as long as they do not violate the rights of others. Yet we continue to see increasing efforts to suppress free expression through government oversight and monitoring. House File 768 pushes back against this overreach by barring the Minnesota Department of Human Rights from creating or maintaining a database that tracks constitutionally protected speech. We have seen past attempts to establish government-run databases to monitor so-called bias incidents. While addressing real threats and unlawful conduct is incredibly important, these databases repeatedly go beyond their intended purposes, and they capture lawful speech, fostering a climate of fear. No Minnesotan should have to worry that their words, whether in a debate, a classroom, or a simple conversation, might be cataloged by the state. When the government agencies track free speech, even with good intentions, they chill open, legal, and protected discourse. People begin to self-censor, and they avoid difficult but necessary conversations. And when speech is suppressed, so is progress. We know that throughout history, societal change has come from open discussion and the ability to challenge prevailing ideas and the courage to speak freely without government reprisal. As the legislative director speaking on behalf of AFP's positions, or just even as an independent citizen with opinions and ideas, you may not like what I have to say, and we may disagree on an issue or how to come forward to a solution, and that is okay. That is part of the free marketplace of ideas. But I will always stand up to protect everybody else's right to free speech. We become in dangerous waters. We get into dangerous waters when we weaponize government to suppress things we just don't like or disagree with. We thank Representative Hudson for bringing this bill forward, and this ensures that Minnesota remains a state where free speech is not only protected but encouraged. We urge your support for this bill, and please stand on the right of on the side of protecting free speech. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify in favor of or with concerns for this bill? Okay, member questions. Thank you for your testimony. Representative Finke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hudson, for your bill. This is another bill that I really do understand and basically support the idea that's being here, if I understand correctly. I did work on potentially bringing an amendment to find a middle way here, because I do think there's something that we could work here. You know, we didn't have time, and I wasn't quite sure how to do it. But I think that what I'm really interested in preserving is, you know, above your addition, there is this, like, the idea of the Minnesota Department of Human Rights putting forward a report each biennium that recommends policy and system changes to prevent further civil rights incidents across Minnesota. I'm very interested in that being a report that the Minnesota Department of Human Rights produces. I'm very interested in trends regarding threats of violence, trends regarding what kind of speech is and is not increasing, right? So we could say that there is protected speech, for example, of an anti-Semitic nature, that should not be perhaps personally recorded in a database, but that information makes its way to the Department of Human Rights, because if this is something that is happening, or Islamophobia, or any marginalized, targeted historical group that is protected by that department, I would like us to be able to have a report that says, hey, this is on the rise. This is something maybe that lawmaker should be aware of. However, de-identified data perhaps would be a solution. I think that there's ways to have a conversation about this, because I do think that protecting the right of, you know, protecting free speech, protecting the First Amendment, protected speech, it's a real concern. And for all of the things that people may or may not think about what we disagree on, what you haven't found me introduce is a bill that penalizes someone for using the language that they use. I don't, that's not something that I do. I want us all to treat everyone with humanity and dignity, because it is the values that we share. It is not about making illegal the speech that people use. And I think that this kind of gets, there is a way for us to figure out how to do both of those things. Because things, speech can accumulate in a way. It bioaccumulates, if you will, like a toxin in the bloodstream. And before you know it, if you're not watching it, you may find yourself in a situation you would have liked to have known was forthcoming. So I'll just end by saying I have been concerned about a couple of the bills that we've heard and the way that they expand responsibility, including legal culpability for actions regarding protest in public. And the thing that most energizes me to see is the protection of our right to assemble and our right to organize. I believe that is extremely under threat in this country, and regardless of what you're organizing on behalf of, we need to protect that right to assemble. So that was a lot, but I just want to say that I do think that we're working in important grounds here, and when I look forward at where this country is going, measuring this out is going to be absolutely essential. So I think that people who maybe are on the different sides of the speech coin should really be having conversations like this to figure out how we're all going to coexist as we really see speech being, I mean, frankly, just criminalized by executive order. And I think that we need to address this very seriously. So thank you for your work. I really would be interested in working on this together.
Vice Chair Hudson, any comments?
Absolutely. Thank you, Madam Chair. And indeed, Representative Finke, you offer a lot that's worthy of chewing on and digesting and discussing. I will start by pointing out that this bill is being laid over, so there's plenty of time. I understand the amendment. I ran into some time considerations myself that graciously were accommodated by your side in terms of getting the author's amendment in. But there is plenty of time to work on this bill, and I'm happy to discuss your ideas and potentially look at altering language in whatever manner seems appropriate. What I will speak to, however, is so this idea that we need to, that the Department of Human Rights, in order to do its work of legitimately protecting folks from discrimination, that there needs to be some degree of monitoring of speech, of trends in thought, I think is a way to fairly characterize it, where we're going to try to detect through some mechanism what people are thinking, what people are saying, where the trend lines are on different ideas, and somehow coalesce that into meaningful data that can inform legislating, I think is a pretty dubious prospect. And this comes back, this bill is a response to a bill in the previous biennium, the previous term. It was HF 181. That I had the opportunity to be on public safety when it was heard multiple occasions. And that bill was going to authorize the Department of Human Rights to solicit, receive, and compile reports of bias incidents, including non-criminal acts. And we discussed this thoroughly in public safety and on the floor. I believe there was probably over an hour-long debate on the topic on the House floor last term. And many examples were offered of the types of incidents that potentially would qualify as being documented in this database that was the objective of HF 181. And there were things such as, you know, somebody standing on a street corner and somebody drives by and yells an insult at them. That's going to be reported to the Department of Human Rights. Okay. How do you verify that actually happened? And time and time again, when we had these back and forths, whether it was in committee or on the House floor, the answer again and again was, well, what matters at the end of the day is how the person receiving the message felt about that message. If they felt that it was biased, motivated by bias, if they felt as though they were somehow being discriminated against, then it qualifies as something that should be documented as this trend of thought that we're going to monitor in order to inform future legislative action. I think it's fairly obvious that the quality of such data would be all but useless. It's entirely arbitrary. It's completely subjective. You're saying we're just going to accept whatever claim somebody offers to the Department of Human Rights, take it on face value, not vet it, not do any sort of analysis of whether or not it, first of all, even actually happened, let alone that it was reported correctly. There's no due process involved in that. And so even if you're using non-identifiable aggregate data, of what value is that aggregate data to actually determining what the real trends of thought are? So even if I were to accept the idea that it's a legitimate governmental exercise for the state to try to monitor trends in thought, which I don't, that mechanism for doing so I don't think would give you accurate aggregate data. But then again, I think the more fundamental point is the state doesn't have a compelling state interest in tracking what people are thinking and what people are saying. So when we go to things like crime, like actual harassment, actual threats, actual discrimination that requires a civil response, we have existing mechanisms in law to deal with those things. The last thing I'll address, simply because you brought it up, is the comparison to our efforts to provide vicarious culpability or vicarious liability for folks who are involved in organizing criminal trespass and damage done to critical infrastructure. Those are crimes. And we're not talking about protest. Like if we're going to put forward the premise that the inability to organize, to trespass upon and damage critical infrastructure somehow prohibits people from protesting, I think we need to look at what our definition of protest is. There's a very clear distinction between speech and criminal action.
Thank you, Vice Chair Hudson. Follow-up, Representative Finke.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. Appreciate your perspectives on all of these issues. I would just say that I don't disagree with what you're saying about trends in thought. I would love to perhaps work together on what is an extremely troubling amount of observation and data collection on trends of thought that are being done by our police departments and our law enforcement agencies, who are doing that extensively on people in your social media accounts, across all of the internet data that is being moved around. That there is the notion that there is not data being collected and used by measuring trends of thought by a lot of people, many of whom have a state interest, that's incorrect. So we should do it one way or the other. We either allow police to use that data to help us find criminals, maybe we can allow our Department of Human Rights to use that data as well. We'll see. Thanks.
Discussion, Vice Chair Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Finke. I must confess I don't know the particulars of what you're talking about regarding your claim that law enforcement is collecting data on trends of thought. Very interested in learning more. Let's have that conversation.
All right. Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. I'm trying to figure out, because we do have a lot of bills moving at the same time that will affect each other. And so when we're talking about vicarious liability, would the bill before us today, would that impede the ability to prosecute people for protesting if we're not allowed to collect that data, especially if that data doesn't identify anybody? Because I'm assuming then the goal is to have that data to go after somebody. So does this bill impede the goals of other bills moving through the process?
Vice Chair Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Curran. To my knowledge, the Minnesota Department of Human Rights is not a law enforcement agency. It does not engage in criminal investigations. And so this bill prohibits the Minnesota Department of Human Rights from collecting a database of protected speech. I don't see how that prohibition would in any way impede the ability of law enforcement to engage in legitimate investigations of criminal activity.
Representative Curran?
Thank you. I'm curious because a larger part of this conversation and the reason why some of this language landed here, and I'm in agreement with that, this is an area that really needs to be gone through with a fine-tooth comb. This is really sensitive. Free speech is obviously something very important to all of us. But I do think that there's merit in the idea that we're collecting data to identify trends, especially if we're going to try to look at if these trends are also trending with criminal actions, criminal behavior, because what we're seeing is as free speech includes hateful speech, speech that incites violence, we do see those occurrences trend up. And so, when we see government officials who are allowed to speak out against minority communities, we do see violence against those communities increase. We see that as people in society view that as more acceptable. They feel more inclined that they can just say whatever they would like to say and walk away without consequence. But the consequence is still there when we have people who are, by large margins over abused and, have criminal acts against them. The idea that maybe public safety is not related to human rights, I fundamentally disagree with. I think attacks on human rights start out as speech. It starts out as testing the waters. It starts out as bullying people to see how far you can get. And at some point, that turns into either violence on the streets or violence that we see promoted through bills that have been entered into this legislature.
Vice Chair Hudson, any response?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you once again, Representative Curran. Just to clarify, so my claim is not that the jurisdiction of public safety or the concept of public safety is somehow detached from human rights conceptually. My claim is that the Minnesota Department of Human Rights is not tasked with engaging in criminal investigations, and therefore this particular bill and its prohibition upon a creation of a database that has protected speech as a target for aggregate data would in any way impede a legitimate criminal investigation. I'd also remind us, if you look at the bill, line 315 through 318, in particular, the definition of protected speech, it says it includes any exercise of the right of freedom of speech or of the press, the right to assemble or petition, or the right of association guaranteed by the United States Constitution, or the Minnesota Constitution. So that's what we're talking about when we talk about protected speech. We're saying that the Department of Human Rights, in its unique specified capacity to uphold and investigate complaints related to discrimination and other violations of civil rights in this state, that process, whatever processes they have, cannot include collecting data on protected speech. And so when we go back to this idea of we need to somehow correlate trends in criminal activity with trends in thought, trends in expression, trends in protected speech, I think there's an inherent constitutional prohibition upon the state doing that. There's clear lines that we draw where we say we're not going to do, in effect, what I perceive you're talking about. We are not going to look inside people's heads or at expressions that they've made in whatever through whatever medium, social media, talking to people, public comments, and then try to detect through this pre-crime process the likelihood that they're going to engage in something that is a criminal activity. We have a very clear line that's drawn in both the Minnesota and United States constitutions to prevent exactly that, a firewall protecting speech, free expression, freedom of the press, freedom of association. We're going to maintain that firewall.
Representative Curran, follow up.
Thank you, Chair. Sure. I'm not really sure what else to say about this other than we all know the communication and the attempted, I don't even know what you want to call it, accusations that happen out in the public under the guise of free speech that end up coming to this place and treating some of us like less than, and I'll leave it at that.
Representative Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a few thoughts. I feel like this bill is like a Rorschach blot, if that's how you say it, like where we all look at it and we see like our feelings. But I'd like to like go back to the language of the bill. I have a few thoughts. The first is that what is speech is actually super complicated, whether something is expressive conduct, what is protected speech, what is criminal, what is a threat. I think that's all very complicated. And I think that the Department of Human Rights in their letter sends us on the road to language that will achieve your goals and is workable. And that was language around only aggregate data, no private, confidential, non-investigative data. And so I think there's room to work on this. I generally think it's a solution in search of a problem, but sometimes we make things that are implicit explicit for a reason, and I respect that. And I think saying that we care about free speech is an important value that maybe we say, even though I don't know that there's an issue here. And so I'd like to go to the report, and I don't know if you've had a chance to look at it, Representative Hudson. It's 19 pages, has a lot of pie charts. On page 4, there are a couple of footnotes that I think are really relevant here. Footnote 1 says this is not the result of an investigation and determination of an alleged charge of discrimination under Minnesota Statute 363A06, subdivision 1-8. Therefore, there is no private, confidential, non-investigative data on any individual governed by the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act, Chapter 13, Human Rights Act, collected or included in this report. And then footnote 2 says this report is not about hate speech. Hating, disliking, or having bias against someone or a group of people on its own is not a violation of any civil rights law. Discussions around how and when speech may be regulated, from commercial speech, obscenity, and speech that is used for inciting imminent lawless action, is not a topic of this report. And then, like I said, there's good pie charts. It's really aggregate, high-level data, just looking at, you know, the constellation of issues that House File 181 was intended to address. And I think it's a good report. You know, I also, I was on board of the ACLU of Minnesota for a while. I'm also a free speech purist. I feel really strongly about it. And I don't have concerns about this report. And the way that House File 181 is being implemented. But like I said, like I do see value sometimes in making things implicit, explicit, and I think there's language here that can achieve your goals and the larger goals. Thanks.
Vice Chair Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Feist. Just for clarity, I don't have the report that you're referencing in front of me. Is that the report that is a result of the it ended up being Senate File 2909 was the final omnibus bill.
Representative Feist.
Yes, it is.
Vice Chair Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Feist. Thank you so much for this question. I looked at the letter submitted from the Department of Human Rights, and I found it really fascinating. Their premise seems to be, one, we're not doing this. Two, if you prohibit us from doing this, it's going to make it really hard for us to do our job. Which strikes me as a little bit like a kid saying, I am most definitely not taking a cookie out of that jar. But if you put a really tight lid on it, you're really going to ruin my day. Doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Like, if they don't need to monitor speech in the way that House File 181 explicitly enabled them to do, then why would explicitly prohibiting them from doing it somehow impede their operations of fulfilling their mandate? And you say this is a solution in search of a problem. I've repeatedly identified what the problem is. The problem is that we have, in the attempt to, well, actually it was ultimately passed in Senate File 2909, this House File 181. It was watered down significantly, but the authority was granted and still exists within the Department of Human Rights to do this. They can do it at any time. They got the money too. It was appropriated. We heard, I believe it was in this committee earlier this session, that they have 90% of that money still retained and that they're not doing this, which is great, but it's a ticking bomb. At any time, they can use that money. They've been authorized in legislation that was passed last year to do this. So the question is, should they do it? And if the answer is no, then we should be advancing this bill to prohibit them from tracking protected speech.
Representative Feist, follow up.
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your response. I think the key issue that I am seeing here is just that the question of what is constitutionally protected free speech is incredibly complex and nuanced. I would imagine there'd be like a fiscal note of some like constitutional professor who'd need to be like on call to be like, well, that's expressive conduct or that's like criminal speech, whatever. So I think that the language that you have here wouldn't work. And to me, I see that as the key issue. In terms of those funds, I think it's up to us this 20th biennium to decide what is the best and highest use of those funds. I do encourage you to look at the report. One of the findings is that restorative practices are a really great way to de-escalate conflict and to ensure accountability and healing for people who've been victimized. And so maybe we want to invest in that.
Vice Chair Hudson, any comment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Feist. So regarding the complexity of determining what is protected speech, perhaps from the perspective of a lawyer, which you are and I am not, there is a great deal of complexity there when you get into the nuance of particular situations. As a broad concept, I think we can discern the difference between what is speech and what is criminal action. Indeed, prior to HF 181 ever being introduced, the Department of Human Rights was engaged in that. Their mandate is to investigate complaints regarding discrimination and other violations of human rights. So they already have to engage in an assessment of, does this complaint qualify as a legitimate complaint within that mandate? And we heard from the department here in this committee regarding how they go through that process. I think they're well-schooled in how to make that discernment, and I don't think prohibiting them from creating a database of aggregate protected speech, whether it's identifiable or not, is going to impede them from doing what they were doing before.
Thank you. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So just something you just said, Representative, is I think I need to push back on a little bit. When you read the Department of Human Rights letter and you say that, you know, there's an inconsistency there, you are making the assumption that your language works to do what you hope it does. And that's exactly the problem. You know, you may not be a lawyer, but you are here writing law. And so words matter. And court cases matter, and all of that backdrop matters, and we have to pay attention to it because that is how any words that we write will be interpreted in light of that. So just a couple of things about this language that you have here, and I also don't necessarily disagree with your underlying concern and premise, but when you look at this language you've written is incredibly broad. And, for example, as I read this, it would prevent the department from collecting police reports that have incidentally protected speech in them. Or, for example, news clippings. You have directly or indirectly. So, you know, that covers a lot of stuff. So I would just say to you that, you know, I really agree with Representative Feist. You know, it's not bad to call out the value, but we have to be mighty careful that you're not, that's why it's stopping the department's work, because it is way too broad and needs a lot more work. But so turning from that, I just want to call out something else here. It's great, you know, we're all very concerned about freedom of speech. I certainly have been, you know, I'm kind of a purist on freedom of speech, too. You know, if the Nazis want to march in Skokie, I also think the ACLU was right to, you know, as much as I hate Nazis, and I do hate Nazis, I think they have the right to march in Skokie, which is what the ACLU defended, and I would defend their right to do that because the First Amendment's a very important value. And I just want to call out here that when we're defending free speech, we have to be willing to defend speech we hate. And that's a really important part of this, right? All speech that is protected speech has to be protected, right? And, you know, so I have a real concern, and, you know, I know that your side doesn't like it when we bring up what's happening on the federal level, but we have a president who is suing news organizations for defamation in order to stop them from, not with legislation, certainly, but very surely stopping them from criticizing him by suing them for defamation. And I wonder if that's something that you support, or would you call that out as being a real threat to free speech, as I believe that it is?
Vice Chair Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Lead Liebling. It's interesting that you bring up the use of lawsuits to quell free expression. In this body, we passed, I believe it was last term, under your majority, an anti-SLAPP law that was specifically targeted at preventing exactly that from public officials through lawsuit against individuals who they don't like, basically harassing them into silence. This language, the language that you pointed out, is lifted straight from that law when it talks about what protected speech is. Specifically, protected speech includes any exercise of the right of freedom of speech or of the press, the right to assemble or petition, or the right of association guaranteed by the United States Constitution or the Minnesota Constitution. When we talk about the ability of the Department of Human Rights being impeded by this language, what the language says is that the Department of Human Rights shall not, directly or indirectly, here's the key, maintain in any collection or database any incident of protected speech. So we're not talking about incidental collections of or incidental obtaining of speech as part of a legitimate process to investigate a claim of discrimination. We're talking about maintaining a collection, maintaining a database of what is protected speech for undefined, undisclosed purposes that could be utilized in the future to justify legislation like we have seen throughout the world. So we have in Germany, there was a recent 60 Minutes segment, CBS News piece showcased how German authorities cracked down on online speech deemed harmful or offensive under the country's stringent speech laws. The report documented early morning police raids targeting individuals suspected of posting content that would incite hatred, including insults or even memes. Unless you think, oh, that's just Germany, we don't need to worry about that here. Just on Monday, we had New York Governor Kathy Hochul announce that the state will ramp up surveillance efforts on social media accounts and that law enforcement will take proactive measures, including contacting people on suspicion of using hate speech, using speech. Suspicion of using speech. So there's a very real and clear intent. You want to focus on what's happening in this country? There's clearly an effort to try to weaponize legitimate concerns about discrimination and civil rights violations in order to encroach upon an area that government has no right to encroach upon. And that is our thoughts, our expressions, our beliefs, our sincerely held values. Government has no business collecting that, surveilling that, documenting it, placing it in a database for purposes that it might decide to implement down the road, like what we've seen in New York and Germany.
Madam Chair. Lead Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Hudson. Well, your language says the Department of Human Rights shall not directly or indirectly maintain in any collection or database any incident of protected speech. That's really broad language, and I believe that would stop them from collecting news clippings that might incidentally contain protected speech or police reports, for example. So I'm just saying here that this language that you have here, instead of kind of saying to the department, you're wrong, it's ridiculous, you're contradicting yourself, maybe you need to like kind of listen to people about what your language is actually doing and tailor it. And I hope you will, because some members here want to work with you. And you know, if we want to make a strong statement about protecting speech, we maybe can do that, but without stepping on things that are not intended here. So, and I do want to comment on your reference to Germany and all of that. You know, Germany has a particular history, and they do not have the same constitutional protection for speech that we have in this country. But you can see why they have it. I'm not saying we should have it in this country. But the reason they have it is because they have seen in a very real way, and not that long ago, how hate speech becomes death camps. That's the problem. And hate speech in this country can become something similar, notwithstanding that we have protection for it. And we have to guard against that thing happening, and it does concern me that we're not all guarding against that thing happening. So I do think there's a concern when police are monitoring people's speech. And I don't know what you said about Kathy Hochul. I don't know if that comes, I think you said it came from a news report. And as we know, news reports aren't always accurate. And we need to probably go to the source to see if that is what she said. But regardless, that's New York. It's not Minnesota. You know, we need to do our work on this to make sure that we are appropriately protecting speech. But you did not answer my question. And I think it's really important. Do you support the President of the United States suing news organizations because they say things he doesn't like? I mean, I'd really like to know that we really all share these values of keeping government from, especially protect the free press, is part of the First Amendment. And yet we have this going on without any concern, apparently, from Republicans. And I hope we can really, no matter where it comes from, we should be calling it out. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Vice Chair Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Lead Liebling. Since we've gone this direction, it's been interesting listening to member commentary from my Democratic colleagues during the presentation of this bill, expressing the sincere desire to affect what it is that I'm trying to accomplish here with my bill. And I've refrained from pointing this out, but since you've decided to turn this into a partisan political show, every single one of you who were serving in the last term voted for this database. Let's not pretend you didn't. You don't get to showboat about how much you love free speech when you brought to the floor and passed, and this governor signed, this ability for the Minnesota Department of Human Rights to track our speech. I shouldn't talk about New York. I shouldn't talk about Germany. How many times have we heard about Trump since this session started? You want to focus? Let's focus on what this bill does. It says the Minnesota Department of Human Rights is not going to maintain a collection or database of protected speech. That shouldn't be controversial. And it shouldn't threaten the ability of any legitimate government agency to do a legitimate governmental job. Now, if you want to work on language that ensures that this is tailored towards my intention of protecting people from being monitored and surveilled in what they think and what they say, while allowing the Minnesota Department of Human Rights to do its job, I'll be more than happy to do that.
Thank you. Representative Mingan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Hard to top that. Representative Liebling, I find it offensive. I find it a form of hate speech, and I object wholeheartedly to your assertion that this bill has language that's objectable. When he's referring to the U.S. Constitution and the Minnesota State Constitution as reasons why the government collecting and maintaining a database for hate speech is somehow okay. But I am so thankful that right now this side of the aisle allows you to say it and doesn't track it. Because as soon as society engages in this back and forth of what is perceived as biased or hurtful, and we use that database to quell and to suppress others from being able to say those sincerely held beliefs, that's when you have violence. That is when society crumbles. And to assert that somehow the language of his bill is what's objectable after having voted to do this. You are not recognizing the fact that the shoe could very, very soon be on the other foot. I implore you guys to vote yes on this bill. I implore you guys to say yes and continue working if there actually is an amendment that you'd like to bring forward. But I've heard two members on that side of the aisle say, of course we value freedom of speech, but there is no but. The government has no interest in doing this.
The bill's author some final words, and then we're going to lay the bill over and move on to Representative Feist's bill. Vice Chair Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll simply conclude. I mean, I think we've thoroughly discussed this bill, so there's not much left that I need to say other than to just clarify, I think, reiterate the positive and productive points, which are there has been an expressed intention to ensure that the intention of this bill is fulfilled. There's been concerns raised about being able to simultaneously somehow affect the spirit of what HF 181 in the last term was trying to accomplish without violating our First Amendment rights. I don't know how we do that, but it's a conversation that's worth having, and I'm willing to pursue it. The bill's being laid over, and also to address Lee Lively's concerns about the Department of Human Rights capacity to do their job with whatever language this ends up being in its final form is something that I'm also very legitimately interested in pursuing. So thank you.
And thank you for the discussion. Next bill is actually a Senate file. Who knew that the Senate would like be on the ball and pass a bill over to us this early, but they did. And so we are going to take up Senate File 202, again, which was passed in the Senate, and the House has given it its first reading and referred it to this committee. And it's the companion to House File 359, which we will lay aside. We will be taking action on the Senate file. Representative Feist, would you like to make the motion to on Senate File 202 to get the bill before us?
Yes, Madam Chair. I move that Senate File 202 be before the committee.
And the motion is that it be sent to the General Register. So we now have the bill before us. Representative Feist, please explain this bill without putting us to sleep.
I was just going to say, you're all going to want to talk about this for like hours, but we only have 5 minutes, unfortunately. Senate File 202 is a bill assembled by the Minnesota State Bar Association. It deals with some technical real property matters. The majority of the bill addresses partition actions, which is a legal process to sell or divide land owned by multiple people. The bill creates a new modernized statute. The language that we have in law right now is from 1905, so it was time. These changes will make the statute much easier for people to actually use. There are two smaller portions of the bill. The first deals with eminent domain and the valuation process. It was worked on by the Minnesota Eminent Domain Institute, which works with landowners, as well as the Minnesota Eminent Domain Council Association, which represents government entities. So both sides came together. And then Article 4 just deals with the transfer on death deeds, which was legislation that I carried last term. We meant to make that retroactive, and we didn't. So we are fixing that, and it just relates to the portion about the transfer on death deeds and not the insurance portion, which was much more complicated. And with that, I will turn it over to the actual expert, Kevin Dunleavy.
Mr. Dunleavy, I meant no disrespect. Okay, you never put us to sleep. Your comments are always very titillating, so please go ahead and introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Madam Chair, as a real estate attorney, I find real estate law very exciting.
I'm sure you do.
Okay, so partition is a division of property between co-owners. I run into it a lot, like mom and dad give the farm, the house, the condo, the lake cabin, or whatever it is to all their kids jointly, and then they want to split it up. Or it can be business partners who like or a hunting cabin or something, any type of real estate where there's more than one owner, you can end up with a partition. This statute was passed in like 1905, and back then real estate, the agricultural land, was the main economic asset in the state, and so it focused on dividing up real estate, and it worked relatively well for that. But now with urbanization and industry compared to 1905, more of the partitions today are family houses and things like that. So with agricultural land, it's partition in kind, where you split up, you get this 40, I get that 40. But with a house, you can't do that. So you have to sell the house and then split the money, or one of the parties buys out the other parties. What this does is it makes it more user-friendly. It reorders the statutes in the way that they work in a lawsuit. There's one referee instead of three, because that reduces the cost, having three people divide how to split the land or how to split the house. The proceeds from the house is expensive. It gives greater judicial discretion. Generally, as a real estate lawyer, when I go to court, I like the judge to have discretion. Hopefully, the judge likes my argument and goes my way, but not always. Then probably one of the main changes is using a realtor as the referee. That cuts away the layer of cost, because generally speaking, if the house is going to be sold and a proceeds split, there's going to be a realtor commission. So now instead of paying for a referee and a realtor and paying twice, the sale only has one commission, and that covers the realtor's fees as a referee. That makes the whole process more cost effective. There is an effective date, so we're going to keep the old chapter for partitions that started before the effective date this in August, and then anything that starts after that date will be under the new chapter. So that we'll have to keep the old chapter around for a while until all the old cases are gone, and then we can repeal it. But that's a ways ahead. Second topic is eminent domain and who gets notice of appeal. So you could have an eminent domain case, like for a highway, where there's 500 parties, and there's only one of them that appeals. Under the present statute, it's not clear whether you have to notify all 500 property owners of this appeal, and there's some dispute in the courts about that as well. So this makes it clear that if only one of the many property owners appeals, that's the only ones that needs to give notice or to get notice in an eminent domain. So that makes it more cost effective. Gives more clarity. Then the last one is Todd's. And I have to apologize, Madam Chair, to you and to Representative Feist, because you sponsored the bill in the last session and I didn't catch this problem.
We're judging you harshly.
I know. I apologize again. I apologize to the committee and Madam Chair and Representative Feist, because I didn't catch it. But we caught it afterwards, and the problem is there are a lot of Todds out there that were recorded that don't have the right county, weren't recorded in the right place, like the county recorder instead of the registrar of titles, and so on. Or somebody dies before the grantor, what happens? People were having to do probates, and this was the whole purpose of this, is to avoid probates. So we're making it retroactive, and again, I apologize that I didn't catch it last year. It's also clear that the insurance provisions, which was taking a lot of attention last year, those are not retroactive. The Insurance Federation doesn't want it to be retroactive, and we're conceding that. So it's just the Todd provisions that are retroactive. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Dunleavy, and you're wholly forgiven, and you will be invited back to this committee. No problem. Any member questions on the bill? All right. Seeing none. Senate file 202 is before us. Is there special language for this? Representative Feist, would you like to renew your motion that Senate file 202 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register?
Yes, Madam Chair. I renew my motion to pass Senate file 202 to the general register.
Perfect. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Very good. Thank you. It's on its way to the general register. Thank you for being here this morning.
Thank you.
And with that, members, we are adjourned.
The selfie together.